What he's going to be speaking about today has been supported by an impressive number of research grants from institutions ranging from the Cannon Institute institution in Washington to the National Council for Eurasian and East European Research. This spring, he will be working in Beijing as part of with the support of a Fulbright research grant, and he's just coming to the completion of the project about which he's speaking to you today. He's one chapter away from being able to submit a history of the Russian Empire and War and Revolution. The Baron, of course, is Ungern Sternberg. I'm assuming that's Tallinn on the left.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And his next exploration of the ongoing interaction, so to put it euphemistically, between Russia and visions of a certain type of Russian empire and tracts of Central Eurasia. So since the title's already up there, I won't have to share that with you. So please join me in welcoming Willard Sunderland.
Thanks very much, David. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for coming, and special thanks to David for his generous invitation. It's a real pleasure to be here and to take you into some of the questions of my research right now. I want to just start by inviting you to the stage of history in this particular moment, the moment I want to talk to you about today. And it's a pretty familiar scene from the history of the Russian Civil War. It's wintertime, it's dawn, and the cavalry attacks from three sides of the town. They push back the defenders, and they drive inside. As the attackers race into the streets, they begin battering down the doors of a smattering of houses. They smash the windows. They scream, "Jews and Bolsheviks, out, 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 you bastards!" They move from one street to the next. Some men known to be Jews or socialists are shot on the spot. Others are beaten and hauled off for interrogation, and then shot, usually quickly thereafter. Jewish women and girls in the town are raped. There's at least one report of an entire family murdered together. Meanwhile, there are other attackers who concentrate on the merchants. Some of them are well-to-do, most of them aren't. But their stalls are ransacked. All their wares are thrown out on the street in these kind of ungainly piles. Some of the unlucky trading folk are killed unceremoniously. Others are taunted, some are hauled up to be beaten and kicked near fires that the men attacking the town have lit to keep themselves warm in the very cold morning. The enemy is ultimately flushed out of the town, and the counter-revolution has won. Now, this could be a page right out of Babel, right out of Red Cavalry, but it's unfolding 5,000 miles to the east of eastern Poland. These events took place in a place the Russians and Westerners called Urga, or now Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia, when the forces of white, at that point, general, Baron Roman Fyodorovich von Ungern Sternberg, or someone I'll just refer to as Ungern for short in my talk, took the town in early February 1921. And some of the set pieces of the story are very familiar from the ordinary tales of violence in the Civil War. The perpetrators here are Cossacks, just as they were in many of the anti-Jewish rampages in the West. Ungern, like many anti-Bolshevik commanders, was a staunch reactionary who despised Jews and Bolsheviks in equal measure and famously ordered them at one point to be exterminated along with their families. And the lootings and rapes that accompanied the taking of the town were commonplaces that we uncover in virtually every episode of Civil War terror, red and white alike. Like most of the pogroms we read about in accounts of the violence of the Civil War, what we see in Urga is some sort of disheartening blend of a popular riot and a military atrocity. It's regrettably very ordinary stuff. But there are some very unusual elements, or at least unusual to me as I stumbled on this history. The men defending Urga were Chinese Republican troops rather than Red Army or Red Partisans. Many of Ungern's Cossacks were not Russians. They weren't even Slavs. They were Buryats, a Mongol people of eastern Russia, as well as soldiers from a range of other nationalities. They were Tatars, Bashkirs, Japanese, Tibetans. Ungern's Cossack force was supplemented by a larger number of Mongol allies from groups that were formerly ruled by the Qing Emperor, Khalkha Mongols, Barga or Bargut Mongols, Chakhars, and others. As the multinational soldiers of Ungern's force, which is known as the Asiatic Division, overran the town, looting and murdering Jews as they went, the Mongolian attackers concentrated on the Chinese. It was they who were ransacking the Chinese stalls in the town. These two pogroms, in effect, unfold together. They kind of interweave with one another. And the key difference between these two waves of violence is that Ungern encouraged the mercilessness towards the Jews and the socialists in the town, but he tried to stop the attacks against the Chinese. This was because, and this is another very unusual and interesting element in this otherwise fairly banal story, the conquest of the town, the taking of Lubga, was linked to a larger plan, a larger vision. Not only to take Urga as a base for operations in north-central Mongolia, but to transform it into the kind of foyer, the entrance hall of a sweeping new imperial building program that would ultimately topple what Ungern saw as the true perversion of republican rule in China and the equally alarming rule of the Bolsheviks in Russia, and would in effect make Eurasia safe again for monarchy. You know, if he had a slogan, that's what it would have been. And as much as we can tell, because Ungern is somewhat cryptic on these points, it seems clear that he realized that to rebuild empires, he needed to build, or I guess in a very basic sense, rebuild an imperial community. And that's why in this particular moment, it made sense to murder Jews and socialists, because they don't fit in the imperial compact. But Chinese merchants do. Ungern was an imperialist who had a place for certain kinds of people in the empire, not for others. So my interest today is approaching the history of the pogrom that I've sort of set up for us in these few brief introductory remarks as an imperial problem. I want to try and understand what happened in the town on that frightening day within the context of imperial history. That is to say, I want to understand the pogrom as an event shaped by imperial habits, structures, sensibilities. I want to argue that the violence, in a basic sense, was imperial. I mean, if we can use that sort of clunky category, imperial violence, inasmuch as this violence was linked to supporting the building of an imperial order. And in a very basic sense, this is all pretty obvious. This is the stuff that sort of leaps out from the record, if only because Russia was an empire, China was an empire, Urga is in between these two empires. Of course, how can we get away from the fact that this event was shaped by an imperial context in the broadest sense? The whole picture is sort of shaped, framed by empire. But as often happens with historians, my sense on reading through all the materials relating to this event is that it's precisely as a frame that empire has been sort of left in this picture. It doesn't really tell us much. It's just treated as a platform for events. In most studies of the revolutions in Mongolia and the interconnection between the turmoil in Mongolia and the Russian Civil War, Ungern's taking of Urga and the violence that flowed with it is either not addressed at all. I mean, that's to say, Urga was simply taken, and the particulars of how it was taken and who had to die for it to be taken are not necessarily deeply explored. Or this event is simply summarized as Ungern's doing alone. It's an expression of his personality. He is the mad baron. That's the way he's been treated in the sort of ringings of history. Here's a fitting episode proving his madness, proving his excess, proving his personal viciousness, extremism, anti-Semitism. What I want to do is actually get away from that perspective a little bit and instead go back to empire, but not as a frame, not as just a setting, but rather as the very stuff of what was going on. So if we really want to make sense of this picture and then relate it to the bigger picture of the turmoil of the time, we have to consider the way in which the empires have intersected here, their structures, their sensibilities, the communities that they created. All of that really helps us to explain what was going on. And of course, Ungern is key to the story. I mean, I'm not suggesting that he's not a part of the picture, but it's not because he was mad. I mean, he may have been mad. I have actually no idea whether he was mad or not. There are all kinds of people who line up in the record to tell you he was quite insane. But we can't really make too much of these judgments. We don't have enough to go on. But we do know that he was an imperial person. The Urga events were shaped by the particular ways of the borderland that he was operating in, this place where Mongolia, China, and Russia run together. But the events there were also related to ideological currents and institutional forms of the broader Tsarist Empire that were brought to this place by imperial people like Ungern, who had a hand in multiple cultural registers, and seems a bit fully at home in what I would call kind of interconnected, multi-imperial sort of condominium or common home of Eurasia, operating very easily from end to end. In fact, we can see some of that illustrated just here in this, in the few images I put on this title slide. These two photographs represent sort of the different poles of Ungern's experience, his life moving from one side of Eurasia to the other. This is a scene of the old town of Tallinn, which the Germans and the Swedes and others knew as Reval. The Russians called it Revel. Ungern's family had a town home on the Germans called the Domberg, and the Estonians called the Tompe, the rise in the middle of the town, and they looked down on this view. In fact, this building here was one of the schools of Ungern's youth. And this picture is from just about 5,000 miles away. This is a picture that I took in western Mongolia near the town of Khovd, a town that the Russians knew in Ungern's time as Khovdu, and the Chinese called Khovdu. These are useful for our imagination because they conjure the tents of nomads. But in most cases, these tents today are by urbanites from Khovd who are just having a summer camp here by the river, picnicking. And Ungern is here in the middle. We'll come back to an image of him in a minute. Anyway, Ungern lived all across these spaces. He was an imperial person in a very obvious geographical sense. He was also very much an imperial person in terms of the cultures that he combined. But what's ironic is that his victims were as well. So socialists and Jews that he identified as his enemies in Urga, they were brought to Urga by the sort of churning winds of empire prior to the conflagrations of the revolution, and then even more so during the revolution itself. So it seems pretty clear that to understand Urga in the larger sense, we really should pay attention to the whole problematic of empire. And it's clear that we need to plug Ungern into it. It's just, to my mind, a question of how we plug him into it, what we read into why he was there and what he was doing. And I am really interested in trying to get to the bottom of Ungern because that's the book I'm writing at the moment. I'm writing this story of Ungern's life that's really just a way of approaching questions about the empire. So he's something of a cipher. We don't know too much about him beyond some of the outposts of his life and some of the broadest possible definitions of where he was and what he was doing. But he takes us to an awful lot of different places. He was geographically promiscuous. He lived in the West, in the East, moved back and forth. And he also spent, and this is very important for my larger argument about the history of the Russian Empire in his time, he lived very much in between empires. He lived on Eurasia's imperial edges in many respects. And he acquired sort of the habits of what I'd call a kind of interstitial living, like living between empires, between imperial cultures. And my methodology in this book is to sort of follow him along. And I'm going to let you in on my secret. How do I flip between these? Can I do that by hitting? Can I get to the next slide? Uh-oh.
You have to open the PowerPoint.
I have to open the PowerPoint. What's happened? I have to open the PowerPoint? Oh, down here. I mean here. Oh, okay, sorry. I was clicking my line. Okay, this is my method in my book. I'm simply along for the ride. I got this from the New Yorker, really. I mean, how often do you get the perfect cartoon in the New Yorker? This is from a few years ago, I can't remember. Anyway, I'm just along for the ride with Unger, and I mean, it's sort of distressing in some respects, certainly by the end of his life, but what's remarkable is you can travel from place to place, and in each place that he inhabits, you can find this interesting mix of imperial limitations and imperial possibilities. And the goal of my book is to kind of string them together and see whether people like Wingeren, because of course he's representative of a certain range of experience within the Russian Empire, whether these people and the way they lived can help us understand a little bit of some of the mystery of their society, those things that are still elusive for us in trying to make sense of how the enormous complexity of Russia held together and holds together still in so many ways. Out of all of these places and the discrete imperial questions I ask about each of them in the book, there are really two very simple and overarching ones that I come back to all the time. How did this world of empire work? Literally, how did it function? How did it hold together? And then, very importantly, because Ungern is maybe even more a guide to answering this question, when, why, and where did it stop working? When, why, where, how did the empire unravel, collapse, cease to function? We could alternatively reframe that last question a little bit, be a little bit skeptical of its premise. Did this empire really indeed stop working? Or did it simply change and begin to work a little bit differently? And in the change, Ungern and people like him lost, but the empire, a lot of the stuff that he was used to living, many of the norms that he associated with, they continued on, albeit in different form. So what I want to do in my talk today is just reflect on these very big questions, but through a very singular vignette, just the very tiniest piece of the fabric of his life. I'm going to start with a thumbnail sketch of Ungern. Then I'm going to shift to consider the bigger imperial context of Urga. And then I'm going to try and conclude with a few reflections on the usefulness of the imperial perspective that I'm suggesting on this event. What does focusing on empire as a mode of analysis, not just as a platform, but as a way of making sense of historical events, what does that perspective help us see that we would otherwise miss seeing? So, first thing is Ungern. Who was he? Can you make that a picture? It's sort of dark.
Bring the lights in front, unless that'll make it too
dark. Oh, well, yeah, I don't know how that'll... Or I tried to light it, light it up with this color behind. So who was Ungern? Well, we can come up with a short answer. He was a number of things. Brief checklist. In the first order, he was a career military officer. By the time he took Urga in February 1921, he was 35 years old. He commanded a division of about 1,200 men, mostly cavalry, with a few cannons and a couple biplanes. He also had, by this time, very long war experience. 3 years of war against the Bolsheviks in the Transbaikal region of eastern Siberia, 4 years in the Great War, a short stint, not terribly dramatic, but still meaningful, in the war with Japan when he was a very young man. He was a Cossack, but not by birth, by service. Having served in the Transbaikal and Amur Cossack hosts as a junior officer prior to the war with Germany. And prior to taking Urga in February, he'd already made 2 failed assaults on the town. So in a sense, this taking of a town was well thought through. In sociological terms, he was a Baltic German aristocrat from Estland, today's Estonia, basically, trained in elite military schools in St. Petersburg. In terms of religion, he was raised a Lutheran, but then he developed a mystical bent that inclined him to aspects of Russian Orthodoxy and Lamaist Buddhism and Mongolian popular religion. In cultural terms, he was a Russianized, German-European, cosmopolitan polyglot. That's how I mean. You can't really get it any shorter than that. He grew up speaking German and French, but then became fluent in Russian, though he spoke with a slight German accent. And you can see him making mistakes in Russian spelling, which doesn't necessarily set him aside from ordinary Russian speakers, but is still interesting to muse upon. You wonder about him smashing his way through Russian as a schoolboy. By the latter part of his life, he had learned some Mongolian, and he knew at least a little Mandarin. We know that. Ideologically speaking, he was a monarchist, an imperialist. He was a conservative modernizer, traditionalist modernizer, I guess. He was an Asianist, in as much he seems to have had a very powerful fascination with the cultures of Asia, particularly East Asia. And he was an anti-Semite. We can read him as a man shaped by, in addition to all these factors, an enormous range of geographical experiences and sort of different social contexts that are introducing him to a variety of violent structures or sort of ways of acting with violence within the empire. This map shows us some of the key points of his life. And a number of ones are left out, but it gives you a certain range of the places where he visited, lived, and served. What were some of the imperial institutions and contexts that he was shaped by? He was shaped by the barracks regimen of his military boarding schools, which is pretty intense stuff when you get into the papers of these schools and realize how these young boys lived. He was shaped by at least one duel with a fellow officer that seems to have left a permanent scar. He served on the Amur frontier here, where we know from the records of his regiment that he was involved in trans-border skirmishes with smugglers and other bandits. He may well have also been involved in some of the sweeps for Jews in far eastern towns like Varavishinsk, when the orders went out to make sure that Jews were sent out of the region. He spent some time in Western Mongolia in the summer of 1913, seeking, if not outright being able to, serve with Mongolian detachments that were then fighting a kind of rear action war against Chinese, supported by the Russians in a proxy-like way. During the Great War, obviously, he had years of organized and semi-organized combat on all the Russian fronts. So from the Baltic to northern Persia, all of these fronts. He was on each of them for some period of time. Then during the Civil War, his area of activity was the Transbaikal, where he served as, in effect, a special commander in really a guerrilla-style war under the nominal control of his boss and former regiment mate, Grigory Semyonov, who becomes more famous as Ataman Semyonov. So with this range of experience, you can see that Ungern turned into a kind of military product who was comfortable in a variety of worlds. He was comfortable with the heel-clicking, uniform-wearing, saluting world of the regular army, the regular Russian Imperial Army, and the less formally organized martial ways of this frontier world of Mongolia, Russia, and China. In fact, it's valuable, I think, to see him as a kind of intermediary between these two martial cultures, on the late Imperial Russian state on the one hand, and the Mongolian steppe on the other. The contrast between these two military cultures can be overdrawn, and I don't want to exaggerate some of the obvious similarities between them, but we can identify at least a couple ways in which they seem to be, on the face of it, quite different. The late imperial military relied on bureaucracy, sociological classification, and industrial technology to pursue the ends, ultimately, of total war, annihilation. The military ways of the Mongolian steppe, by contrast, even in Ungern's time, valorized the place of sort of political charisma of the warrior, the power of a sort of brutal display, raiding and extortion rather than annihilation. And Ungern sort of fit within both of these registers. He worked between them. So that's Ungern in a very tight nutshell. I mean, we can see that in many respects he comes to us as an imperial product shaped by an imperial system and also very much by a particular imperial frontier. So now I want to shift to figuring out Urga, the place of the atrocity. Urga, the Urga that sort of opened up before Ungern in February 1921, was a very, I'd say, kind of loaded spot for him to apply his sort of wealth of violent experience. Urga, which is known as Suriye in Mongolian, then had a population of about 60,000 people. Now, it's virtually impossible to conjure what Urga was at the time by going to Ulaanbaatar today. Ulaanbaatar is well over a million people today. So it's fantastically huge city by comparison with what it was less than 100 years ago. And in that time, it was supposed to be, as far as many Mongols were concerned, the capital of an independent state, independent Mongolia. But Mongolian independence that had been declared from the Qing in 1911 had by 1919 effectively disappeared. The Chinese Republicans were very good at being just as imperialist as the Qing, had returned in effect to Mongolia, and they had replaced the old imperial order with pretensions to a new order of their own. There was a Chinese garrison in the town. They lived off of exactions from the local people, requisitions of different sorts. The Mongol theocratic ruler, the Bogda, who had been, in effect, installed as an independent ruler in 1911, had been placed under house arrest by the Chinese, and he was forced to kowtow to a portrait of the Chinese president. So there were very obvious evocations of an older way of doing things. What was the position of the Russians in the town? Well, it was very weak. For the preceding, most of the preceding period, the Russians had presented themselves to the Mongolians as their protector, the counterweight against the imperial pretensions of the Chinese. By the same token, the Russians had been wary of actually acquiring Mongolia as a province of the Russian Empire. For all of the supposed rapaciousness of Russian imperial expansion, Russian statesmen frequently recognized useful limits to the extension of Russian power, and Mongolian independence was actually frowned upon by the most influential men of the Russian government in the 19-teens, who saw a much better spot for Russia in Mongolia if Mongolia remained a kind of autonomous region within China. It was just a question of trying to shore up a certain latitude for Mongolian autonomy within a Chinese system rather than supporting Mongolian independence outright. But by positioning themselves as patrons of the Mongolians, they enjoyed a certain favor in Urga in the 1910s. There was a kind of rash of Russophilia in the town. But a lot of this dimmed quickly as the empire became enmeshed in the Great War in the West. Russia's interest and ability to influence events in Mongolia dips, and even though China begins to pass through its own period of remarkable upheaval, this vacuum becomes an obvious one, drawing back the Chinese. By early 1921, besides the Russian consular staff and a corps of a few hundred permanent expatriates, most of whom were merchants running their own small trading companies or representing some larger Siberian firms, most of the roughly 2,000 Russians in the town were refugees who had fled the mayhem in Russia. A couple hundred of them, as best I can tell from piecing together different accounts, were stragglers from white forces who had slipped into Mongolia as the Red Army advanced against Semyonov's fiefdom in eastern Siberia. A minority of these Russians in the town were socialists, including a tiny number of what seemed to be, professional Bolshevik activists. Some of the permanent merchants in the town were Jews. In Urga, for the same reason that they were in places like Harbin or Hailar, for that matter, these towns on the Chinese Eastern Railway, because Russia's ability to influence these East Asian borderlands brought with it opportunities for enrichment, business opportunities. And just that one extra step away from the powers of Russian deportation. So some of the Jews who were in Urga at the time of Ungern's arrival related to that older migration, a kind of neo-colonial migration that took place in the preceding decades. But others obviously were brought here by the sort of waves of dislocation that swept over Siberia. But Urga was not an easy place to get to. There's no train line here. It's not an obvious destination for refugees. What's a crude summary of how the different communities of this city were getting along on the eve of Ungern's conquest? Well, I'd say it goes as follows. This is very brief. The Mongolians, they hated the Chinese. The Chinese were suspicious of both the Mongolians and the Russians, while the Russians sympathized with the Mongolians, distrusted the Chinese, and intensely disliked each other. Inasmuch as they were divided by the same ideological and social cleavages that divided the rest of their compatriots back home. In fact, all of these communities, despite my sort of funny little sketch there, were riven by incredible divides. Some of the most meaningful of these divides followed lines of status. Some followed lines of ethnicity or clan in the case of Mongol groups. Certainly as the winter set in, this very complicated nest of interlocking communities was kind of under pressure. You know? The cold had set in, food was in short supply, fuel was in short supply, prices were going up, anxieties were going up. And most of the resentments and suspicions in Urga were very clearly the result of the dramatic seesawing of imperial fortune in this place. Russia's star had risen, then waned. China's star had virtually fallen and then came roaring back. In fact, it's helpful to see Ungern's assault on the town as part of this mix of competing imperial pretensions, since in many respects it was an attempt at a resurgence of Russian power in Mongolia that was aimed at getting rid of a traditional opponent, the Chinese, that is, in this case, the Republican Chinese, that whom Ungern saw as completely anathema. And as it turned out, Mongolian independence hung entirely on this interplay of imperialisms. So the operative question in Urga was not whether imperial power would be imposed to shape Mongolia's future in some way. It was really a question of whose empire would prevail in this gambit between different rivals. And what's very special about this moment is something that I think can be glossed over too quickly when we look at this story from other angles, is that this is a moment of post-empire, post-empire. But when the post, like the hyphen, has just been written, it's like the ink on the hyphen of post-empire is so fresh that you can imagine that it was a spelling error. You could just rub it out, put the empire back. You know, I was trying to think of ways in which to conceive how fragile this whole post-empire proposition was. It's like a moment of reconstruction, what the Russians call it, kapitalny remont. Like, we're going to just take apart the whole place. So we're going to take everything out and put it on the street. We're going to take out the whole clunky refrigerator. That's the Russian Empire. We're going to throw it out. We're going to throw out the Chinese Empire. It's gone. But then you realize, well, it's gone, but it's right there on the curb. It's right there on the curb. So could we bring it back in? And in fact, in this moment, what's remarkable is the transition is so fresh that even for the most vociferous advocates of the Kapitalny Remont, the Bolsheviks, the ultimate supposed anti-imperialists, the big question is not so much the empire that will be, because that actually sort of, in some respects, is sort of resolved, at least in this propaganda moment. We know that there won't be an empire. But there is a big question about what to do with this enormous space in the room where the refrigerator should be, you know, where all the stuff should be that you fall down. And if we conceive of the freshness of this moment, then some of what Ungern was proposing to do becomes much more palpable. Like, we can see that it was possible, that it might have been believable for him and his followers. So the violence that unfolded in Urga in 1921 was deeply intertwined with imperial realities and ambitions. And it took place in this very special very fresh post-imperial junction. So is it useful to explore the violence that took place there as imperial violence, as violence informed by an imperial way of life, in effect? Now, I would argue yes, but that's not necessarily terribly helpful because obviously there are many varieties of imperial violence, and the category is really only meaningful if we apply it judiciously to special contexts. Violence was a constant companion to Russian empire building, the maintenance of the empire. It acquires many different forms across time and space, many different analogs. Frontier expansion in Siberia and on the steppe, for example, was quite similar to early European conquests of the New World. The frontier wars that we see led by figures like Batyr Shah or Pugachev, they're very similar to nativist-style revolts, like, say, the Andean revolt of Tupac Amaru in the Andean highlands in the 1780s. Russian colonial wars in places like the Caucasus and Turkestan were very similar to campaigns in French Algeria and British Sudan. If we want to invent a category called imperial violence, we'd also have to fill it with a number of other types of violent power. Terrorism, a wide variety of pogroms, many interstate wars, imperial rivalry. In a given context, one type of imperial violence might actually very easily flow alongside or into others, and it's not really necessarily all that clear where one type of violence stops and another begins. It strikes me that if we want to take imperial violence into the picture of what we see in Urgad, that idea, that understanding, then what we see is actually a variety of forms of imperial violence intersecting. There are two pogroms that are wrapped in a frontier war that was linked, at least in Ungern's mind, to a larger war of imperial restoration. So there are a variety of different forms of imperial violence that are kind of wrapped together. Can't really necessarily take them apart. But the value of proposing that empire is an important part of what explains this violence, it strikes me, is also clear. If we put empire into the analysis, we're able to get a better view of the grid of war and social and ethnic hostility, even hatred, and also imperialist ambition. That was a very fertile mix of the way in which these communities and states were interacting in this time. Historians have paid an awful lot of attention to the phenomenon of total war and state collapse that shattered the Russian Empire and the empires that neighbored it on the western side of the state. But we tend to forget that the Russian Empire was convulsed at the same time by another shatter zone, a shatter zone in this region, in the Far East. And if we think about empire as a useful category for making sense of these shatterings, then we can see that they were actually interconnected in very, very practical, you might say, visceral ways, by people like Ungern, who moved between these two ends of the state. Pogroms occurred in each zone. Imperial ambitions drove the violence in similar ways, east and west. And in fact, the sacking of Urgad can be seen as a kind of deplorable proof of the whole Eurasian paradigm, the interconnectedness of this vast space. And that's something that we miss when we tell the story of Ungern's Mongolian campaign and the taking of Urgad in particular as just another aspect of the Russian Civil War. In fact, it was part of a broader process of imperial dissolution that affected all the ends of this enormous space. At the same time, it was also very much a story of this particular frontier. As frontiers are not generic, and they have obvious similarities. That is to say, we can find clear reasons for considering the Trans-Mississippi West right up against the Transvaal, right up against the Transbaikal. I mean, there are similar processes unfolding in each of these places, but there are also very useful special characteristics that separate them. And if we want to understand the particulars of the pogrom here, then we should also get down to figuring out some of the particulars of this imperial frontier. And just to keep things brief, I would say that there are three things that make this particular imperial frontier sort of special, at least in this moment. One is the interconnected geography of this space. Ungern's taking of Urga was made possible by the phenomenon of state collapse. Just to keep a very complicated picture artificially simple. Well, along with this state collapse, we also see the unraveling of borders, including an attempt at a would-be border in this part of Russia's East Asian frontier. The Qing and Russian empires had attempted to build up a border here in the preceding two decades. And to a degree, it functioned. I mean, you could go to certain spaces where you saw something that looked like a border all around you. But the problem is, of course, you could go just two versti away and see no trace of that border at all. Well, the phenomenon of state collapse and the broader interconnected social mayhem of this moment dissolves even that pretension at a border. And so all of these spaces revert to a much older way of interconnecting in effect as ends of a common zone, a frontier zone, connecting the Transbaikal, Mongolia, northern Manchuria as well. Ungern was sort of proficient in the language of this frontier, and he took advantage of these changes. The ideology that he brought to bear on this space reflected a sense of these interconnected spaces. There were all kinds of pan-Mongolian propositions to put together a greater Mongolia combined or made up of all of the different Mongol peoples from the eastern Kazakh steppe to northern Manchuria, including the territories of the Buryats. There were propositions, obviously, of world revolution that were going to be moving through this space to create even larger connections. And so Ungern's proposition of reconstituting empires was just another card played into this vision of interconnecting spaces, though in his case, it was a vision of sort of winding the clock back and piecing together states that had fallen apart. The other, another distinguishing characteristic of this frontier, this imperial frontier, was the phenomenon of warlordism. So state collapse opens up a vacuum of power, and in this broader region, that vacuum is ultimately occupied by regional military commanders on the Russian and the Chinese side. The most obvious one on the Russian side in this part of the world was Ataman Semyonov, Ungern's nominal boss. On the Chinese side, much more ultimately powerful as a national figure warlord, Zhang Zhulin. And for that matter, another regional warlord here in Urga. In taking the war into Mongolia, Ungern was sort of stepping into an already tested institution. He was kind of putting on, in effect, the shoes of warlordism, understanding it as one of, in effect, the institutions of this particular frontier. And the third characteristic that makes this imperial frontier distinct in this particular moment is the multicultural nature of Ungern's fighting force. That itself was not anomalous, this so-called Asiatic division. There's a history of non-Russian fighting forces in the Russian Imperial Army, a history of a certain amount of hesitation on the part of Russian imperial authorities to use these forces. That hesitation is sort of broken in the Russian imperial context by the February Revolution, which opens up new possibilities for forming these non-Russian units. Ungern was himself involved in trying to put together these units in Persia. He ends up in eastern Siberia and pursues, in effect, the same operation. We see in the Chinese context, interesting, complex institution of the Qing banners, a similar interest in making use of, in effect, ethnic militaries. Right? In the context of the social turmoil, the state breakdown, the border collapse that shaped this moment, Ungern's force becomes a catch-all for just about anybody who's willing to sign up. So you have Buryats, Russians, many of whom are Transbaikal Cossacks. You have Tatars, Bashkirs, Japanese mercenaries, Tibetans who sign on for the cause of sort of ridding Mongolia of the Chinese. In effect, anybody who agreed to sign the wispy slips that you can still find in the archive, agreeing to fight for the Asiatic Division and be paid in a certain coinage. They were taken, regardless of their other credentials. And my reading of this moment is that it's the particular inter-ethnic dynamic of this interconnected space that allows for a division like this to be a meaningful and useful military instrument. Big open question, though, as I finish here, is how this type of fighting force becomes an agent of a different sort of imperial ideology, an ideology of imperial anti-Semitism. On the face of it, it's just bizarre. Anti-Semitism, by and large, is not a story of the Siberian experience. First of all, very few Jews, though that doesn't necessarily have too much to do with presence or not of anti-Semitism. But very importantly, very few instances of organized violence against Jews, even in periods when that kind of violence was much more intense in other parts of the empire. Why does a frontier force that we know was sufficiently open and eclectic as to take just about every comer become the instrument serving, in some respects, by comparison, a more narrow view of an imperial community in which one group is defined from the outset as being unacceptable, worthy of destruction? My answer to this question is that it's again locked in the story or rooted in the story of the imperial transformation, the transformations of the empire in this period. Many of the men who were fighting with Ungern had fought in the fronts of the Great War. They had been influenced and connected to the culture of the war in the Russian West, right? So what we call the Eastern Front. Anti-Semitic propaganda was an important part of the Russian military establishment in the time of the war. We can't trace Ungern personally, and I haven't been able to trace that many of his men because I only see some of the names of his men, and I haven't been able to find them in their various regiments when they were fighting in the Great War, to particular pogroms. But we know, based on where they were fighting, that they were around anti-Jewish violence, either before, after, or during. And we know that they performed, like Ungern, these violent migrations, these movements across the empire, bringing this ideology of a kind of generalized Jewish enemy with them. But activating that hatred and turning it into an instrument of killing, I think, is a special moment. And my sense is that what explains that here is really just opportunism. So we have Ungern, who's standing for a very powerful anti-Semitic ideology, ultimately embracing what amounts to, in effect, an eliminationist view of Jews, that they need to be simply wiped out because they are congenitally predisposed to Bolshevism, to radicalism. They have perverted Russia's monarchical tradition. They have to be eliminated. My sense is that the men of Ungern's division, I have no idea. I have no way of tracing what they might have thought, but it seems hard to believe that they would have necessarily gone along with all the particulars of this point of view, but they certainly would have gone along with taking advantage of the opportunism of violence that unfolded in the taking of the town. And this map shows us something of the assault from the three different sides here. And as the Russians and their Tibetan and Mongolian allies came into the town and they flushed out the Chinese defenses that were they were especially strong here around the Chinese trading town, and pushed the Chinese out ultimately towards the Russian border at Kyakhta, where they found refuge among the Bolsheviks, who were in charge of the border at that time. The killings began instantly. And Ungern had explicitly directed killings against Jews and socialists. Many of these men, because they lived within this interconnected frontier, they knew where people lived. They had the addresses. They had the sheets of the local Russian newspaper with the names, names like Scheinemann, Klinsburg. So-and-so was a teacher. So-and-so was a lawyer. So-and-so owned the tannery. They would go. They would find these men and their families, and they would be, in most cases, executed on the spot. And Ungern, apparently, this we don't know from what he said and wrote down, but from accounts left by men in the division, he promised, you know, in effect, the proceeds of the sacking of the town. One-third to the division, two-thirds to the men. So my sense is that his anti-Semitism provided a kind of intellectual justification for these murders and a very practical looting and military desperation actually made the murders happen on the ground. Ultimately, what Ungern was proposing was a reconstitution of an old empire. For that empire to have meaning, it had to have a community. And in that imperial community, there was simply no room for groups that Ungern recognized as congenital enemies. And these groups were very few. It was just the Jews and the socialists. Everybody else was fine. Everybody else. All the old peoples of the Russian Empire, the Chinese Empire. He was envisioning, in effect, a reconstitution of the imperial houses of Eurasia, in which the Qing were brought back to power in Beijing. The Mongolians enjoyed the old autonomy that they had under the good Qing emperors, who respected Mongol institutions, Mongols running their own affairs. And in Russia, the Romanovs would be returned to the throne, not under Nicholas. Ungern knew that he had bitten the dust, but under his brother, Mikhail II. This is the banner of the Asiatic Division, which Ungern, in effect, commissioned for the division prior to the turn in his story that ultimately allows us to get the best possible view on what he was doing. His attempt to invade what was by that point Red Siberia in May 1921, so just a few months after taking Urga, ultimately his attempt at moving into Siberia was repulsed by the Red Army. One thing leads to another, and ultimately he's captured by the Bolsheviks, who at the same time have themselves moved into Mongolia, and with the assistance of their Mongol allies, so-called Red Mongols, taken over Urga and are well on their way to ultimately establishing exactly what Ungern didn't want, which is an outpost of a different form mega, you know, quasi-imperial power, but this time ruled from Moscow. So I know I've gone a little bit over. Let me try and answer my very last question as to why taking this approach to the problem is useful. Let's say why would it be in any respects useful to look at all of this from the imperial angle? I think there are just three very simple reasons why I found this approach productive for me in trying to make sense of this moment. First of all, it really does put the question of the person, or the individual, in a certain perspective. You know, certain individuals in history are clearly overwhelmingly important, but you still can't say that it was Lenin's October Revolution. Just as you really, despite my title, can't really say that it was Ungern's Mongolian pogrom. I mean, these individuals are leaving their mark on these events. They're shaping them in certain ways. But there's so many more, bigger, more complex factors that are making these events come around. If we just tie them to the individual, then we lose some of the complexity and appreciation of some of the complexity of the moment. But the other thing that I think taking the empire view allows us to see is the remarkable interconnectedness of the turmoil of the period. So the turmoil in the West is concretely linked to the turmoil in the East in the optic of the Russian Empire. And so many of the other categories that we use to analyze the Russian Revolution and Civil War, categories like class, nation, gender, they obviously reveal the remarkable complexity of this period. In many respects, they sort of break up the picture. But if we put empire as a category into our consideration, then we see some very sweeping commonalities to the picture. And in fact, you could argue that the Russian Revolution needs to be sort of reconsidered in a very profound way as an imperial revolution. It was something we don't usually interpret in these terms, but I think is very apt. I mean, the revolution takes place in an empire. Its leading protagonists are imperialists or anti-imperialists of different sorts. Its most significant geopolitical result was the destruction of one imperial state and its replacement with something that a lot of people took to be another imperial state. The basic struggle of the revolution, what Lenin called tokavo, who's going to win. In some very basic sense, it was an argument over who would be in power of this combined space. And there was absolutely no argument that the space would be combined. I mean, there was very little argument about the fact that all of this had somehow hanged together in some form or another. And if we insist on looking at empire not just as the platform in which the revolution's unfolding, but actually the stuff of how the revolution is taking place, and I think we see it in terms that are more true to the time, or at least help us to see another truth in the time. And finally, the reason why I think looking at empire in this particular story is really useful is because it also takes us into a simple salient fact of the Russian imperial experience in this time, that it really is not the story of one empire, that Russia's history as an empire can only be understood by looking at Russia in its engagement with other imperial spaces and polities. So the pogrom in Urga, or the broader Mongolian campaign, which this is just one story, is usually told as a story of the Russian civil war in eastern Siberia or of the foundation of Mongolian independence under communist overlordship, in effect. But if we insist on a different narrative, then we see ultimately a different combination of trajectories. That this was a pogrom that was connecting imperial spaces. It was the product of empires that were always running together in a certain respect. And its particular qualities, this explosion of violence was made possible by the undoing of a certain kind of imperial arrangement that allowed for this space to be occupied by frontier warriors like Ungern, and then was kind of closed up again as a new set of imperial, sort of a new equation of imperial power returns. And for me personally, it's been very useful to insist on this imperial way of looking at things, because otherwise the simple strangeness of this event is almost impossible to understand. Thank you very much. So we can take.
I'm assuming you can feel your own.
Oh yes, yeah. Please.